Hi everyone, big news. We've been nominated for a British Podcast Award in the lifestyle category. So thank you so much for all your support so far. And we're really proud of ourselves because we have been going for just 1 year. We're absolutely chuffed, but there's one more thing. There is a Listener's Choice Awards and it's now open. And you get to vote for the podcast you love listening to. And if you can vote for us, we'd really, really appreciate it. So if you go to www.britishpodcastawards.com/voting and vote for This Is Powerful with Paul Scorful. It's open till the 8th of September. Your voting means a lot to us. Thank you for your support. We're really excited to be in the running for this.
Telling my story, I find that it's the only way that I can be better, right? Because for years, I had kept it all inside, bottled it up, right? And didn't share, right? And felt like I couldn't talk about it. And those are the things that led me down the darkest path of my life. Part of what was keeping me in that process was using the construct and the mentality of saying, well, it doesn't matter. I broke my own heart. What I learned was by sharing my story, being open with who I am, it felt like I was being reborn.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scorful. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, I've got a special guest, Scott Barnhill, who's a long-term friend of mine. Scott Barnhill's presence in the modeling world is iconic. As one of America's models, who shaped the fashion industry in the 90s and the early 2000s. He has fronted campaigns for luxury brands like Versace, Yves Saint Laurent, Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger, and many, many more. Today, Scott's journey has taken a new creative direction as he leads the band Scott and the 1015. I've known Scott since the early 90s, where we both modeled in Milan, Paris, New York, and everywhere. And I must say, he is a terrific guy. I was blown away by this conversation we had, especially when Scott talks about his teeth, which we'll get into, his awakening and his recovery. So please enjoy. Scott, welcome to This Is Powerful. Mate, I'm so happy you're coming here. Thank you so much for your time.
I know it's been some time that we haven't seen each other, and I mean, it's really great. It's a really cool reunion.
Scott, I'd love to go back to the beginning and let us know where you're from, what kind of upbringing you had.
I'm from Chicago, Illinois, born and raised up until my early teen years. Growing up, I grew up in a house, a couple houses, because I was always bouncing back and forth in between my mother and my father. It was always a custody thing. When I was a child, 5 years old, I was kidnapped and sexually abused, which later in my life led to a lot of dark, dark places for me. I buried that, you know, at a young age. I didn't know really what it was, right? All I kept on hearing in my head was, do you know the story about the boy who cried wolf? Right. So in my story, I always felt that I wasn't believed. Right. Like it almost like it didn't happen. But visually, clearly, I can pick you up all the details and fill you in on everything down to the smell in the air the day that it happened, right? Fast forward to 11, 12 years old, I moved to Florida with my mother went to school down here. Because of always being back and forth in between my mother and my father, from the time that I was in first grade to the time that I was in eighth grade, I had went to 7 different schools. Kicked out of one and then finally ended up at a special youth program school for troubled kids. And there I graduated in my eighth grade and went on to high school. First year of high school, I dropped out of school and went and learned the trades, construction work, electrical work, doing all sorts of odd jobs for a general contractor that we'd go in and we'd fix up everything that was messed up throughout the production of the building so that way they could pass inspections. So I found myself from cutting holes in, you know, concrete walls where there should have been a window and they didn't put the window in, cutting that out, all the way to doing tile work. I literally did something of everything within the trades. So that's what I was doing when I was 16, 17 years old and got scouted out by the infamous Cindy Cooper. Literally, my brother and a couple of my friends took me out for a little surprise get together. And my brother—
Where was this, Scott?
Pleasure Island at the time, Walt Disney World. And went inside and was playing air hockey at an air hockey table. I wasn't old enough to drink. I shouldn't have probably been in there, but I was. And playing air hockey, and a lady came up to me, and her name's Cindy Cooper. She came up to me and said, are you a model? I said, no, I'm not. She ended up giving me her number on a napkin because she was out of business cards, right? So my friends, they kind of made the joke, oh, like, you know, this lady's trying to pick up on you. Fast forward 2 weeks later, I come home from my construction job and I put on the TV and it happens to be the VH1 Fashion Awards. And I'm watching it and kind of learning quick, right, what modeling looks like. To me, when I started modeling, you were already a legend, right? Like, I looked up to you in the industry. I was like, man, this guy's got it going on, right? Like,
I thought he was going to say this guy's very old.
No, not at all. Like, I thought, like, I perceived you as always having, like, your shit together and being the mincing male model from England, right? Like, super dapper. Like, I literally, like, you were probably one of the only male models I looked up to. Right? Because everybody else that I had met had this edge to them, that, like, this arrogance, right? And you didn't have that. You were always very matter of fact. And I always appreciated that.
I appreciate that, Scott. And I just want to say, thank you for sharing what you shared earlier, mate. I didn't know that.
Of course. You know, in telling my story, I find that it's the only way that I can be better, right? Because for years, I had kept it all inside, bottled it up, right? And didn't share, right? And felt like I couldn't talk about it. And those are the things that led me down the darkest path of my life. The suicide attempts, right? The overdosing and the drugs. Just the journey into the drugs alone, right? Like, it compiled. And I realized late in my journey that part of what was keeping me in that process was using the construct and the mentality of saying, well, it doesn't matter. I broke my own heart, right? Since I broke my own heart, nothing matters, right? And that was my excuse to not finally come back to life, right? Which now I have. But that was my mental frame, right? What I learned was by sharing my story, being open with who I am and identifying myself, right, as who I am, that saying, like, I can love myself, right? Like, I'm allowed to love myself. And in that, right, like, I found this world of like protection and integrity and confidence, right? Like it felt like I was being reborn, right? Like I'm coming back to life.
Good for you, brother. I totally and utterly identify with that. So you got scouted and you saw, you was watching the awards on TV.
Yep. And how I remember it is Tyson Beckford was actually winning. He won for Male Model of the Year. For those who don't know who Tyson is, he was a famous supermodel that worked extensively with Ralph Lauren in the 90s. And as I'm seeing the videos of the runner-up, like who was to win, I was like, wow, modeling actually kind of looks cool. I think I could do that. So I went and I was wearing a flannel shirt that night. I went and found my flannel and I pulled out the number out of my chest pocket where I had put it. And I called Cindy Cooper.
What did you ask her?
I said, so what's this modeling thing about? Like, what do I need to do? And she right away just without hesitation jumped in. Okay, we need to get pictures of you. I'm going to send you down to Miami. You're going to meet, a photographer. You're going to do some tests, but can you get to Miami? Do you have transportation? I was like, yes, yes. So it all like fast tracked, right? Next thing you know, I was going to Miami and meeting an agency. And I met Paige Parks at the time. It was the only agency I went into. So I went into it and I met a man there who came out to see me. And his name was Rob Sadowski. And Rob, I guess, contacted Cindy right away and said, we want to represent him 100%. And then literally before I left that trip on Miami, I was test shooting with two photographers. They worked as a group, a team. And that was Dart and Jake Bow. And I test with them and then went back home, right? And that was kind of my intro into the world. So shortly after that, I was asked if I could move down to Miami so I can go on castings and appointments and go-sees. I did. I took a model's apartment with another model at the time. Two other models. I was just like, I've skateboarded almost my whole life. So I was just like this skater kid in Miami going on go-sees and castings. And they were like very like, they'd go to the gym and they were like the models, right? They were like health orientated, right? And me, I was just like learning quick, like skincare routines, right? About good soaps to use. Like I just got thrown in. I just was quiet and I observed everything that happened around me. I did all that and I got maybe one or two little jobs. I think in the 6 months that I lived in Miami, I went into debt with the agency, like, I don't know, almost $3,000. Yeah, and like I'm in this model apartment, which wasn't our typical model apartment. It was an apartment that we got together. So it wasn't like I didn't have to worry about roommates coming in and out, right? It was always us. It was just us at this place. So I started looking for a job and I found a job working as, a store hand at Danskin, which is a ladies' dance apparel shop, or a dance apparel shop. We don't have to say ladies, but yeah. And so I was working there, making a regular paycheck, right? And then going out from there and going on my appointments. And so then I started, feeling a little bit more at ease with things because I had a job, right?
Yeah.
Well, the job didn't last that long. There was a situation and the store had just opened. They had hired too many people. I was the one to go. So they let me go. And after that, I couldn't sustain living in Miami and trying to do this model thing. So I went back home to try and get my old construction job back. Couldn't get the job back because they changed their kind of scope of what they were doing and they didn't need me anymore or didn't want to use me, whatever it was. So I literally got a job at a gas station pumping gas. So I was working that job and I get a phone call from Rob in Miami saying, hey, can you come to Miami for a casting? it's for Diesel Jeans. He just said it's for a good client and it's with a really great photographer. And I went down and, you know, so this whole time, I guess the agents are all working, right, on the backside, like sending my card out, sending things out, right? And they're trying to create that, you know, buzz, right? That snowball, right, thing.
Yeah.
So I go down to Miami and I go to the casting and I meet Ellen Van Unworth. And
no way.
Yeah, literally. And
she's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. So she essentially, she hires me for the job. Now, for the job, I get paid driving time, right? Which I didn't know even existed, right? Like, so I'm getting paid.
It doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't, yeah. So I get paid driving time and then the day rate and then there's a usage rate, right? So I'm in Central Florida, pretty much, right? And the job was shooting at the Tiki Bar at Isle Mirada. So I drive my car down there and it's about a 6-hour drive. I arrive at the job and you know, we talk, she's like, oh, do you have any other surfer friends, right? And just coincidentally in my center console, I had a group picture, like, you know, one of those roll pictures that you get out of a photo booth, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had a group of friends that we were all crammed in the photo booth together. And I'm like, here, look. And she looks, she's like, oh yeah, him right there, him. Can you see if he wants to come and do this too? And literally, I call him up. He's like, yeah, man, I'll totally do it. So then she was like, okay, well, now you got to go get him. So I had to.
Who was this? Who was the friend?
My buddy, Brian Natale. He's not a model. It was just a one-off. And so I drove from the Keys back up to my area, picked up Brian, and then drove back down, right? I'm like, man, this is the best I've ever been paid, and I haven't even done the job yet, right? So we go and we do the shoot, and part of the shoot was I'm in my underwear on a beach poking like what you would think would be like something dead in the water with a stick, right? And I'm thinking in my head, like, this is weird. Like, okay, but I'm going with it. Like, I'm just doing it, right? Like, I have my stick and there's like ice skates and like I'm poking at the ice skates that are in the surf that's coming up onto the beach, right? And you know, like, oh, looking over it, like, you know. So I do the job, and Ellen was absolutely amazing. And that was my first real big modeling gig, right?
And that was a good big gig to get.
Yeah, so I leave that gig, and now all of a sudden I'm not in debt anymore with the agency. And I drive back home, and literally the next day they're like, hey, you're going to New York. Met Steven Meisel, started shooting right away, and then the rest was history.
It's incredible how things can turn, right?
Yeah, it's amazing, right? Like, literally from the time that I watched that TV, the next year, I was nominated for Top Male Model of the Year.
It must have been so surreal.
So surreal. An amazing experience. You know, flash forward to now, 30 years later, still working in the industry, right? And doing what I love. I'm writing music and making short films, videos, right? And revamping and reinvigorating myself in life and in the arts, which I love so much.
How was alcohol and drugs taking part for you then, Scott, after you won stuff? And
drugs and alcohol have always kind of been around my life since I was young. I did a lot of acid and mushrooms, right? And smoked a lot of weed. At an early age, right? But when I got into the fashion industry, I was clean. All I did was drink a little bit, right? It wasn't that I kind of already went through this like drug phase, right? I never did cocaine or heroin or, you know, pills. And I said, oh, you know, I would never do heroin. I'd never put a needle in my arm. So, you know, that was that. Flash forward to around 2000, I ran off and got married. That didn't work out so well. So in that, she was the one that introduced me to cocaine. So I was at doing European shows, and I believe it was in France. And we were out drinking at a club, just normal stuff. And then she introduced me to cocaine. So started doing the cocaine, and then it became more prominent. Then depression started coming on with that. So as I moved through that, I was like, you know what? Like, this isn't a good marriage. So I got out of the marriage. I walked away from that. The only thing that I took was I kept the drugs going. I came back home to my hometown. All my friends that, you know, I had around here, they were all on drugs. So when I came back, it made it easy to keep on doing drugs. So I kept on doing the coke, right? And kept on doing that. And then the more coke you do, the more alcohol you drink, the more depressed I was getting. Everything was just kind of snowballing. And it kind of came to a head around, I think, 2003-ish. And like, that was it, right? Like, I was like, oh, it's over, right? I'm not going to work anymore. Well, at the time, an agent of mine reached out, and he was like, you know what? We're going to get you a contract in Japan. You'll be away from the drugs and the alcohol, right? And this will be good for you, right? So I did that, and I had some ups and downs in Japan, but I pulled through. I went and saw a doctor. They diagnosed me with like ADHD and like a bipolar 2 disorder. So they gave me Ritalin and Valium, which then kind of replaced the cocaine. But I wasn't getting that excessive boost from it, so I started taking that too much. I came back from the contract in Japan. And mind you, while I was there, I passed out in the shower at one point, and I punctured a hole in my lung. They were able to repair it, and they were able to save it, right? So I have good lungs now, but that happened. So I come back from this contract over there, and I'm back in town for maybe a week, week and a half, and right away, the same people that were around me with the drugs, making everything accessible, were back around me. So I said, no, I got to get out of here, and talked with the agent again. And he was like, all right, let's get you over to Paris. So I went to Paris for the shows, and then I just never left. In moving to Paris, I wasn't doing the drugs. I was just doing alcohol at first, right? And in France, the level of drinking isn't the same, right, as it is in the States or in Europe in general. Where I might have been borderline alcoholic here, I was now in France where it was normalized, and I wasn't even close to being an alcoholic. So I just drank a lot, right? But I was working and everything was good. But then all good things, they say, come to an end, right? So I found a way to get back into drugs, and I started doing drugs again in Paris. Coming out of that, I started getting homesick, and I came back home after about, I don't know, six years of living in France, 7 years living in France.
Oh, you stayed there for quite some time then.
Yeah, I did. So I came back home to Florida. And at the time, I had built up musically what I was doing, right? So I had now being recognized as a music artist, right? Which was good because the modeling was kind of, you know, wavering off. So, you know, I was happy and in a good place. And I got offered to play a show in New York. So I go up and I play the gig. And when I'm there, an old girlfriend had, you know, I was talking to at the time, said, you know, I still have this guitar. You left it here last time you were there. And I said, oh, great. Can we meet up so I can get it? She agreed. And we met up. And when we met up, we just stayed together, right? Like, we didn't part. And that then carried me through the next couple of years in New York. And we actually had a child together. So I have a son who, is not unfortunately in my life at the moment, but that's something that I work on all the time. And eventually I know, you know, I'll be back in his life. So in New York, and as that relationship is starting to wane and the music isn't, you know, nothing happens overnight, right? It's like with music and career. So I started working. Well, we knew the baby was coming, so I had to start working more and more. So it literally got to a point where I was working 16 hours a day doing production stuff between set design and production to, you know, feel like everything was going. Well, my boss at the time did a lot of drugs, right? And so it made it accessible again to me. So as this is happening, to maintain this lifestyle of working all these hours, I start doing drugs and I'm drinking again. So I lose my girl, I lose my son, and I break my own heart because now I become the person that I said I would never become. So in breaking my heart or in falling apart, let's call it what it is, I couldn't handle anything. I had, you know, no capacity to do so. I wanted to die at this point. I turned to heavier drugs. I turned to methamphetamines.
How old is you at this point, Scott?
I was well into my 30s, 38 years old, right? And I dive into heroin. And that was it, right? I wanted to die. I spent the next 7 years of my life like literally trying to kill myself without actually putting a gun to my head, pulling the trigger, or hanging myself to where somebody would have to come in and see my body. I figured if I could just do this much more drugs this time, put the needle in my arm, I won't have to wake up. I'll be gone. Right?
Yeah. And it's really sad and it's hard to talk about because I understand exactly where you've been. So I appreciate you saying it, mate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's the thing, right? Like, when you're young, it's like, oh, don't do drugs, right? Okay, yeah, whatever. And then it's like, drugs aren't cool, right? And like, but then you're a kid and you're like experimenting, right? And you're like having fun, right? And then you kind of grow out of it, right? Like everybody goes through that stage. I hit it so late in life that I was using it as a crutch to not deal with the fact that I was abused as a child, that I would never be the father to my son that I wish that I had, that I felt that I didn't have, right? Like, yeah. I like between the depression, right, and the excuses of like not wanting to live, right? Like, I completely destroyed everything. If you were in my path, you would have ran for the hills. If, right, like, I'll just give you an image, right? I'm driving a 68 Impala square body. I got a gun in my waistband, no shirt on. I got a big straw hat on and a plate of cocaine. And I'm doing lines as I'm driving through these backwoods and back roads. And I have a friend who's in the car next to me. We were in the middle of nowhere. And he's like, dude, you're gonna die if you keep on going like this. And I looked over at him and I said, this is the fucking train you're on. If you don't like my train, you get the fuck off my tracks. I pulled over, kicked him out of the car. He ran, right? And I just drove off. Like, I was on a one-way road, like, one-way train to fucking hell, and there was nobody there that was gonna help me, that could help me or stop me. A couple of years before that, I thought because of the cocaine and the alcohol, I had a problem. So I went and checked myself into a rehab place. They monitored me for 24 hours. They told me, you have no vitals, you have no problems. Are you sure you even drink? I sat up from that desk and walked out the door and said, my problem isn't anybody else's. There's nobody that's going to save me. Right? Yeah. The rehab place said I didn't even have a problem. And this was my mental thinking at the time. Well, if that's not a problem, then I could do more. I'm going to do so much more until somebody says I have a problem. And nobody would say, Scott, you have a fucking problem. You need help. And I didn't want the help anyway. So there wouldn't have been any, you know, there wouldn't have been nothing anybody could have done probably.
It's interesting because I think people get to such a point where you become totally unapproachable.
Yeah. Yeah. I went from hiding everything that I did, and I was good at hiding it, or I thought I was anyway, right? To out in the wild, like just wiling out, like I don't give up, right? Like not caring. There was a moment where I was so high at one point, like I had a gun on me and I'm at like a forest preserve park. And the ranger comes up to me and we start talking. And the ranger is like, we're talking about guns, and I'm showing my gun to the ranger, and the ranger is showing me their piece. And we start talking about breakdancing. Like, who in the fuck, like, they don't realize that I'm fucked up, right? Like, at what point does someone say, like, hey, you know?
It sounds like that really he was crying for help, for someone just to grab you by the lapels and be like, Scott, fucking, you're in pain, man. Yeah. Let's sort this out.
And that was the last thing I told my son's mother before I completely snapped. I said, I was like literally on my knees, right? I said, I need help. I need you to help me right now. And she couldn't. And I get that. I understand that. When I couldn't get the help from that moment on, it was a constant cry, a constant physical torture, trying to die, right? Like, I'm not worth saving. I'm breaking my own heart. I'm worthless. There's nothing in this world, right? Like, I need to die. Like, I don't deserve to be here. Like, you know, I deserve to be in hell. And I tried my hardest and everything I could do to create that hell around me.
How do you get from there back to where you are now, making music, being creative, you know, being a good man, stand-up guy, clearly wanting to get the boy back into life, starting to modeling again? How does that happen?
Do you believe in God? Right? Can I ask you, like, do you believe in God, Paul? Right? Like, not trying to put you on Front Street, you know, but like,
yeah.
Do you believe in like karma, right? Like, it's the universe, right? It's God, it's energy, right? It's karma. It's all those things, right? It's magic, right? It's wisdom and more, right? That help us drive our every day. What started out as a voice in my head that said, Scott, what are you doing to yourself? This isn't you. And that's the voice that I heard when I'm lying on the jail cell floor, right? With my arms tucked in my shirt, overdosing, and they don't know that I'm overdosing in there at that moment, saying, this isn't you. You got to love yourself, man. That's the only love you're going to get is from you. That was that moment that I said, never again. Right when that happened, I didn't get medical treatment, right? I just passed out there, woke up 6 hours later when they picked me up out of the room to transport me. So they didn't know what was happening to me. I woke up out of there and said, I will never do drugs again in my life. I will never drink again in my life. I felt this weight when I said to myself, I'm going to love myself, just lift off my shoulders. It was at that moment, from the first time that I could remember, since I was a child, 5 years old, I said, oh my God, I don't need to throw myself down the stairs, right? To be loved. I don't need to lie. I don't need to do drugs. I could be who the hell I am meant to be. I am me. And I love myself, right? Wow. And it was from that moment on that I was like, yo, this is the world that you're meant to be in. You're meant to live in this world with love. You're meant to be loved. You're meant to love, right? And beyond that, right? It's okay to be who you are.
We all have voices in our head, and you're bad, you're shit, you're this and that.
Yeah.
But to hear something as clear as day like that,
yeah,
and have a physical experience.
Physical experience, like the weight of the world just lifted off my shoulder. And all of a sudden I felt like, I swear, like I felt like I did the day before I got kidnapped, right? Like I felt like I was,
oh man,
like young again, right? I felt invigorated, right? Like I was like, so I took my whole prison, like I ended up in prison, right? Not trying to jump ahead of the story, but I took it all on the chin. You know, I could have been fucked up the whole time in prison. Everybody, like Florida prison system, the drugs that are in there and the contraband is insane. I could have been high the whole time, but I didn't. I stayed sober. I stayed straight. I got out. And don't get me wrong, there's challenges. It hasn't been easy. So how I ask you about God and all the esoteric things and the energy, right? Having that and wanting that in your head and in your soul, right? You kind of project something. And so in that, like when I got out of prison, for instance, right? all my teeth were jacked up. I had like literally no teeth left in my mouth. What am I going to do with that? I can't get back into modeling. I got to figure out what I'm going to do. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll become a truck driver. Well, I need to be out of prison for 5 years. Otherwise, their insurance companies won't insure you. So I couldn't become a truck driver.
No way. Yeah.
Couldn't become a truck driver. So I said, well, I'm really good with welding. I'll become a professional welder. Well, a lot of the welding jobs, right, that I was looking at too, you need a thing called a BIC card, which is for your international ports and securities, right? I could become a welder professionally licensed, but I couldn't get hired for the job because I'm on government properties, right? At points of entry, international points of entry.
Wow.
So I couldn't do that. So I'm trying to figure it out. Now, I told you earlier in the story, I dropped out of high school. I didn't even have a GED. So I said, okay, let's start here. I want to get my GED. I enrolled into the adult program at the Wilbur Wright Community College in Chicago. I take my GED and I pass. That was my first step. Still screwed up teeth. I need to do something about this. Well, I had a couple, like $1,800, right, on a card, like a debit card that they gave me from work release, because I was at work release. So, you know, you can make money at work release. And I'm doing some research, like affordable dentures, right, like this and that, right, like in implants. I read the reviews of this great doctor, Dr. Patel, in Chicago at the Brickyard at Affordable Dentures, right? And I go in and he's like, okay, first of all, before we do anything, all we can do is pull all your teeth that you do have. There's nothing we can do to save those. They're shot. They're done. And we can give you like these, you know, startup dentures, right? This is what it is. So that's what I do. So I get the dentures, right? And I'm wearing dentures and I'm wearing them for a few months, right? I'm going around and at the same time, a few things happened and somebody needed some construction work done and another buddy needed another job done. And, you know, so I go and I do these odd jobs, right? Now I come back to Chicago and I'm like, okay, the dentures aren't really cutting it. I'm never going to be able to sing, right, or really perform because they'll just fly out of my mouth. So I have some money saved up now from doing those jobs, right, that I just did, those odd jobs. I made upwards almost $6,000. So I go back to the dentist. He sits me down. He's like, you know what? You have to be one of the most humblest people that I've ever met. He's like, when you walked out of here, one of his assistants realized who I was. He was like, your story is insane, dude. He was like, my God, you were like the top of the top. He asked me, what do you want to be able to do? I said, I want to be able to sing. I want to be able to laugh without my teeth flying out of my mouth, right?
Yeah, and being conscious of them probably.
And he's like, okay. He's like, give me a week. I'm going to talk with my team and I'm going to see what I can do, right? I had no clue, right? I'm thinking they're just going to get me some, like, maybe some snap-in dentures, right? Like the next upgrade, right? I go back in the week later for the appointment and he looks at me, he sits me down in his chair and he's like, listen, like I literally cried, right? Like I'm in my dentist chair bawling, right? Like eyes coming out of my head. And he looks at me and he says, I talked with my team. I'm going to fly in my specialist from Dallas and my other guy from Florida. And we're going to do a full reconstructive mouth surgery on you and give you full uppers and bottoms, full implants. And we just want to film it a little bit, right? And kind of have you on film doing this. And that's all it's going to cost you. So a godsend. Like my recovery, right, it's been a road, right? It was the prison, right? It's coming out of prison. It's getting back to life, learning the jobs that I can do, this and that. And then all of a sudden, like I'm meeting people that like here comes the belief in the God and the esoterics and the religion. Like it came from the universe, right? In all forms, like I said, of, you know, wisdom, you know, magic, right? Spirituality, God, everything. Like it was just a true angel, Dr. Patel, out of the Brickyard in Chicago, right? And when I'm in Chicago, part of the way that I got some of that money that I was talking about that I was saving up, my French agency reaches out to me and they're like, where have you been? And I'm like, I've been in prison.
Did you tell them straight?
Yeah, I said nice. Straight. They were like, oh my God, like, we thought something had happened to you, but like, we didn't know. Like, we're glad you're alive. Are you good? And they had been seeing my Facebook posts, right? So they knew that I was healthy, right?
Yeah.
They were like, you look really good. And now at this point, I'm only have dentures though, right? Like I don't have the teeth in. They're like, well, you know, we have money on account here from your last job that you did in like 2017 with us. I was like, what? I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was some money. So now I need to open up a bank account again, getting my life back together to be able to get this money transferred over. So that was part of this, you know, $6,000 that I saved up, right? And then in that, right, I guess, you know, which was a godsend, Lexi and John Galliano, they hire me to come out and do the Cinema Inferno show, right?
Wow.
And man, like that was a godsend again, like put a little bit of money in my pocket. And it was my first job back. I still don't think that everybody knows the full story of what I'm sharing with you. They will never know, like they will only know by what I say, right? And it will forever, like I'll forever be in debt to them for bringing me out to do that show, right? And what started as a small part turned into like me getting lines, right? And then all of a sudden, right, like I'm father too, which like gets killed off. I'm playing this character who is like sexually abusing this child. So like, it was like this whole kind of like Americano cinematic moment of like reflections of my life drawing through this character. And that's the first job that I'm doing back.
Wow. That's right? Mad.
So it was like that's literally, crazy. Yeah, it was literally the final killing off of the bad person that I become, the evil person who I've become, right? Live on stage in a fashion like forum on the one of the biggest fashion stages, right, of all time, doing this intoxicating, like organic reality, like of my life projected in through this character that I'm able to just like be like, hey, I'm here. And it's like I never left. And then get shot and killed, that character get shot and killed, right? Like, it was like, that could have been my last job ever. And like, to me, it was like, it was like perfect because it was like killing off all the old me, like bang, bang, you're dead, right? Like
wow,
the abused child, right? The drug addicted, crazy, like alcoholic Scott that like I became just got killed in front of the fashion world. Live on stage. And like, nobody knows like my story and like what that meant to me.
Did you go to bed at night just thinking, what the fuck is going on?
You cannot make this shit up. And then since then, it's just been slow and steady, right? And you know what? It's only because of everybody along the way, right? It's like having a second chance at my life within the life that I'm rebuilding and not wasting any of it, right? And just being humble and grateful and so appreciative.
You can't not be but humble from experiencing such pain and desperation.
It's 100%. There's no way that you, like you have gone through, right? What you've gone through or someone like me can without being humble. Because we know what it's like on the smallest, simplest terms of what it's like to not have a door held, right? You will always hold the door, right? For somebody, right? And that's what I'm hoping, right? Like, and that's why I believe you do what you do, is because you want to be there to hold the door to show somebody, hey, there is another way. And it's not the fact of being better, right? It's not, that's not the challenge, right? And to bring all that back and to really say something, right, that that can maybe hopefully be impactful, right, would be, you have to love yourself, right? You have to find a way to love yourself with all your flaws, with all your mistakes, right? With all your fucked up choices, right? Find a way, just a little bit of love for yourself. Have a little bit of compassion for yourself, right? And if you can find that, right, then you found the key, right, to literally coming back to life, right, to living, to be alive.
We're going to leave it there, Scott. Thank you so much, buddy.
Thank you, buddy.
That was amazing.
Awesome.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.